Welcome to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nygut. This hour, why is the Census Bureau testing a citizenship question after federal courts ruled it can't be asked in the 2020 headcount? Before an Atlanta audience of national conservative leaders, Vice President Pence lays out the case for Donald Trump's re-election. And anger builds in the northern suburbs over a plant residents fear is spewing cancer-causing chemicals. We have a lot to talk about on today's show. Let's get going and meet today's panel. Of course, it's a day for Jim Galloway to be here as my sidekick on the show, the lead political writer for the AJC. You read him on Wednesdays and Sundays in the Dead Tree edition of the AJC, and you continue to oversee the Political Insider blog at AJC.com. Welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
It's good to have you here. Across from you, Michael Thurmond. Michael, of course, is currently the CEO of DeKalb County, but he's been in just about every job in elected office. He was the labor commissioner for the state of Georgia. He was superintendent of schools in DeKalb County at a time when he really had to right that ship. You were a candidate for United States Senate in the 2010 race. And who knows what your political future might be, Mr. Thurmond? Would you like to talk about it today?
Honored to be with you, Bill. Always a joy.
It's good to have you here, Mike Thurmond. Jackie Gingrich Cushman is back with us. She's had a busy summer with children, and we haven't had you on as much as we like to. Jackie, of course, is a conservative writer, blogger. And we are proud to be able to say, Jackie, that you are about to be a published book. Well, you've written several books, so that was an unfair thing to say. But you have a brand new one coming out next month.
I do. I have a brand new book coming out September 17th.
What's it called?
Our Broken America, Why Both Sides Need to Stop Ranting and Start Listening.
And let me guess.
You know, wait.
Who's writing the foreword?
Yeah, we do have to ask. Wait a minute. This is a book. Stop ranting and start what?
Listening. Okay. And that's why.
And her dad, Newt, wrote
it. Absolutely. I actually discussed that in the book. So, you know, if it causes a little interest in conversation, that's even better. But I think it's really important for us at this time in our nation's history to really learn to listen to each other and not just scream at each other.
Well, amen to that.
Thank you.
And you and I are scheduled next month to sit down and do a show specifically about all of the ideas that you talk about in your book, and I'm really looking forward to that. So congratulations on yet another new book, Jackie.
Thank you.
And we're also really happy to welcome to today's show Hanzi-Lo Wang, who is the census correspondent, reporter for National Public Radio, you said based in New York.
That's right.
And you're here for the Asian American, the Conference of Asian American Journalists, right?
Right, the Asian American Journalists Association annual meeting, and I'll be speaking about the census there as well.
Well, we're really thrilled to have you here because your reporting on the census gives us some information that many of us did not know before, and you can help us with a perspective on where we're headed in this 2020 census. So let me ask you a first question, and then everybody can get involved. One of the things that you've reported that Jim Galloway and I were struck by is that despite the fact that we followed the journey of the citizenship question in the courts, which the Trump administration wanted to add, which the courts have absolutely said no to, despite all that, you reported, I think in the last week, that the Census Bureau is testing a citizenship question. And they're doing it a little late in the game, right? They do test questions, you tell us, but usually far in advance of the next census. And this suddenly pops up. Am I right?
Right. The testing usually happens for new questions or any changes to a census form years before headcount starts because they want to really know how the public will react and whether or not changes should be made and how it could affect the results. But because the Trump administration made a really last-minute push for this question, formally submitting a request at the end of 2017 before the planned question topics had already been set, the Census Bureau was trying to figure out a way of how to get some type of data, some type of information to figure out whether or not it would need to hire more workers, change its advertising campaign based on how the public would react to a citizenship question. And the plans were put in place before the courts made their final decision, before the Supreme Court made its decision. And the Census Bureau was trying to put it in place so that we'd have results in case the question was on and in case any future officials want to add this question for future census forms.
I think you tell us that these test questions go out about half a million people or so. Was that, do I have that right? And about half of those people got this census question? I mean, the citizenship question?
Right. About a half million households randomly selected around the country to ask to answer questionnaires. Not everyone is getting a paper form. Most people are getting a letter with a link. At this point, if they haven't filled out that form, they're probably getting a paper form. And half of those forms, about a quarter million, include a citizenship question. Is this person a citizen of the United States? The other half does not.
Jim, are they trying to generate some statistics that might prove Tom Hoffeller's kind of contention? He's the North Carolina Republican and gerrymander strategist who initiated this push for the citizenship question. For various states, including Georgia, possibly to use.
Right. The results of this specific test, and they're calling it the 2019 census test, have nothing to do with redistricting, nothing to do really with a population count. This is strictly to essentially gauge public reaction to specifically the citizenship question and to figure out how people respond, whether people don't respond.
Yeah. So really it's a test to see whether or not asking the question has a different result in terms of comparison, right, in the two. So one group gets it, one group does not get it. And is there a difference in terms of who responds?
It's really measuring
a response rate. Right. It's a response rate test. So it really has nothing to do, to your point, with the census or where we're going in terms of, you know, the count currently or what the next.
Right. It won't be part of the 2020
but
census.
I think it is good information for this. I'm not saying the timing, but I'm saying it's good information for them to have. Maybe they should have done it earlier in a different way. But I think it's good to know, what does that question do? There's a lot of speculation, and there have been other things that have been talked about. But to have that real data to say we've actually run a real test in here, and we don't know the answer. So, I mean, we speculate right now what the answer would be. I think it's that information will be valuable.
But, you know, Mike, of course, in right now in the age of Trump, after even all the courts ruled on this, the president still insisted we'll figure out a way to get this on the census, and then he dropped that plan when he realized there really wasn't any way. So, given all that, when you see the reporting that Hansi did here, you say to yourself, is there something going on that we need to worry about? And I think actually you interviewed at least one or two people who felt this, who were nervous about the same thing. Am I right?
Right. I mean, there's a lot of confusion because not only is there a citizenship question on this 2019 census test, but there are other Census Bureau surveys that the government conducts, including the American Community Survey. It's an ongoing survey, and that does have a citizenship question. It's had a citizenship question ever since that survey began in 2005. And that's actually the main vehicle of how the government collects citizenship data to enforce, for example, the Voting Rights Act. How do we make sure the voting rights of racial minorities are protected? It's through the citizenship data collected from that survey. But people weren't aware of that. There's a lot more attention about what the Census Bureau does, specifically about citizenship information. And so it's causing a lot of confusion and raising questions.
Mike?
Well, I think in a broader context, what this, as was just stated, we're in a very toxic environment now where there's a high level of sensitivity around issues of immigration and citizenship. And on another plane, and I don't know specifically what the timing is, but I would ask the question, was this a face-saving effort for the president who, during the run-up and throughout this debate, insisted categorically that this question would be on the census? And whether intended or not, it presents an opportunity for face-saving in a political sense.
I mean, I would guess to say he's moved on to the next thing. I mean, Trump, you know, when something doesn't work,
really,
he moves on really fast. I don't know if y'all have noticed that or not. I mean, you got to remember, this is a, I try to tell people, this is a man who was a New York developer who became a reality TV star who then became our president. So when you think about how he acts and what he does, you can't think about a standard politician. You can't think about what would President Clinton have done or what would, you know, President Bushes have done. This is a totally different person with a totally different background, with a totally different way of thinking. And so he probably doesn't remember, oh, my gosh, the Census Bureau, they have to have years to figure out these questions to make sure they're right to do it. I mean, he's used to breaking things and moving fast. And so he just, something doesn't work, he moves to the next thing.
But you know what's, the other thing in your reporting that I thought was interesting was you talk about the American Community Survey, which has been asking a citizenship mm-hmm. question since 2005. So if that's the case, doesn't it to some extent, although I know we're looking back at something that's already been decided by the courts, but doesn't that raise even more questions about why the administration's excuse for why they wanted the citizenship question in the first place?
Well, that is what the challengers of the citizenship question, that's part of their argument in court, which was there already is citizenship information that the government has used. And we have to remember back the Trump administration, at least the stated reason it said that it wanted to add a citizenship question was to better enforce the Voting Rights Act.
Can I move on? Because I know we've only got you for a limited time before you have to go speak at the conference. Something you've been reporting on extensively is efforts to mobilize minority communities to respond to the census, partly more than ever because of what Mike Thurman discussed, which is suspicions among minority communities, Hispanic communities, I would guess in particular, although you'll tell me if I'm wrong, and community organizations are out there making sure people respond to the survey, the census, right?
Right. This is really trying to fulfill a constitutional mandate. It's to count every person living in the country, regardless of citizenship status, regardless of immigration status. And those numbers determine how power and money are essentially distributed around the country over the next decade. So getting every person living in the country counted is really a priority for a lot of immigrant rights groups, communities of color, because those are the groups that the Census Bureau describes as hard to count groups, that most of the public in the country, a majority white population, that population generally is actually been overcounted in past census counts. But the groups that have been undercounted are traditionally communities of color, immigrant communities, communities who, for English, is not their first language. And so the special attention is being made by the Census Bureau through advertising campaign and partnering with local community groups, including one that I shadowed in Queens, New York, Make the Road New York. They were one of the plaintiffs in the citizenship question lawsuit. Now they're kind of shifting their focus now to making sure that immigrant communities in New York know about the census, know why it's important, and try to assuage any fears and concerns about handing over personal information to the government.
There's also an emphasis on counting children under five. Is there not now?
Yes. One of the most undercounted groups are children under five, and a lot of different reasons for that, and partly because the families are a lot more complex now, and so young children could be left out because they may be living in multiple households, or folks might not know that children should be counted in the census. And so the Census Bureau is trying to encourage families to make sure that young children under five are counted.
And as a local elected official, Bill, literally hundreds of millions of dollars are hanging in the balance in terms of federal appropriations to local and state governments to serve and support various populations. Having served in the school district, one of the things that surprises most people is there's no citizenship test in terms of providing public education to children. You cannot inquire as to the citizenship status of a child or a parent if they present themselves at a schoolhouse door. You must provide them with education.
So you've got to have funds.
Yes.
So they've got to be counted so the money for your school, whatever funding is coming your way,
Yes.
takes them into account.
And typically children who speak English as a second language, that presents a greater challenge. That's why the funding is so necessary.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, everyone should be counted. And I think one of the things I learned in your reporting was that the Census Bureau actually can't share information about citizenship status. Is that correct? And if so, like for 72 years, or what is the regulation around what information can be shared?
So the protections are under Title 13 of the U.S. Code, and specifically the Census Bureau cannot share responses identifying individuals, whether they be about citizenship, which the 2020 Census will not be collecting information about through the questionnaire, but race, ethnicity, people's ages, for example. Information identifying individuals cannot be shared until 72 years after that information is collected. If you've done any genealogy research into your family tree, you may have seen old census records, but you have to wait 72 years before you can actually see your great-grandparents' name, for example, exactly where they lived, who they lived with.
Right.
But in general, the Census Bureau can release information, anonymized information about specific demographic groups at a level as local as a local neighborhood.
Right.
And that is released regularly, and that's what redistricting officials use in part to draw new voting maps.
But also helps, to your point, if you have all the children under five and you know who's coming up in your schools,
yes,
you can plan properly to know in 3 years how many people you're going to have in elementary school. But I think it's really important that people understand that everyone should be counted, because there is no one going to track them down personally. And I think, quite frankly, part of the, I think the the sadness about this ongoing discussion is that a lot of people have gotten misinformation and have become scared for reasons that they shouldn't be scared. And so hopefully people will go out and make sure that they are counted in the census because it is really important.
Jim, please help me if I don't walk you through this properly, but I think when we've talked census before, you've made the point that it's one thing to count every individual regardless of their status in this country and understand that, that federal funds are going to be distributed on that basis. It's another thing to look at how they figure into redistricting, congressional right. redistricting, if they're not voters. And so there's kind of a parallel track there. And yet those figures are used to determine whether we add or lose a member of Congress, for instance, electoral college right. votes for a state, right?
Right, right, right. What opponents of the citizenship question were alleging is that this is basically, this was a Republican effort to build a database that state governments could use. Not this would not apply to federal redistricting, but state governments could use citizenship counts as a basis for their own redistricting.
Legislative, not congressional.
Legislative, gotcha. School board, county commission, gotcha. City council. The genesis of that was Tom Hofheller.
Hanzi, can you weigh in on that?
Sure. This is Thomas Hofheller, a GOP redistricting strategist. He died in August, last August, and his hard drive surfaced as part of these lawsuits over the citizenship question. And one of these documents that were part of these hard drives included an unpublished study where he said that if voting districts were drawn based on not the total residents of a given area, but on only citizens old enough to vote, eligible right. voters, that would produce essentially political maps that would be, quote, advantageous to Republicans and non-Hispanic whites. And it's important to point out that even though the Trump administration is no longer pushing for a citizenship question on the 2020 census, it is still moving forward with another way of getting the citizenship information that Thomas Hofheller outlined said is necessary in order to do this, this strategy. And this is through existing government records from right. other federal agencies, including the Social Security Administration, Department of Homeland Security, and the State Department. Those are records that actually last year the Trump administration authorized the Census Bureau to start collecting, compiling, and now the Census Bureau has formal instructions to prepare that information to release to redistricting officials in 2021.
Before we take a break, and before we have to say goodbye to Hanzi, Mike, he talked about organizations across the country that are working to ensure people respond to the census. What kind of efforts are underway in DeKalb County?
A significant effort is underway being led by our Commissioner Larry Johnson. We recognize the importance, particularly in a county such as DeKalb, where we have a large immigrant population within our jurisdiction. It is extremely important for DeKalb, and Atlanta is doing the same because we know the significance of undercounting people of color. And it's redistricting, too. You all have been through the process in the Georgia General Assembly as a reporter, and Jim, Bo, and me as a legislator. There's nothing more intense and with so much at stake than reapportionment, and particularly in a state like Georgia that is undergoing a major transition. 5,000-10,000 residents in a specific part of the state can literally shift control of a house or a Senate, yeah. or a commission, right. or a school board.
All right. Hanzi Lo Wang, we're really grateful that you stopped in for a few minutes to talk with us about your beat. People can read your stories, listen to your stories on the NPR website, obviously. Is there a specific NPR.org, but is there a slash that they can go to get to you specifically?
I can't think of it off the top of my head. But I am on Twitter. I tweet a lot about the census.
Oh, you do? Yes. Okay, what's your Twitter handle?
Hanzi Lo Wang.
All right, fine. Thank you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for
having
me.
Have a good time over at the conference, and we'll be listening for your report.
Thank you very much.
Vice President Pence, Hanzi's not the only guy in town today. The Vice President of the United States is here. He spoke over at Eric Erickson's gathering of conservatives. We're going to take a little bit of what he had to say, talk about it. And the Democratic Socialists are in town, too. I wonder if there's going to be a rumble. This is Political Rewind. We'll be right back.
Are you thinking of getting rid of your old car, truck, or RV? GPB's Vehicle Donation Program is here to help. donating has never been easier. We'll take care of everything, including free pickup of your vehicle. Just go to gpb.org/cars or call 877-GPB-1-CAR. That's 877-472-1227. And thanks so much. Beep, 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 yeah.
Some people in Paradise, California are rebuilding after the deadly campfire, but they're getting mixed messages from officials about whether the water is safe to drink.
The flip-flopping is what causes me more stress, knowing that one day it's fine, a couple weeks later, oops, it's not.
I'm Audie Cornish, the water crisis in Paradise, this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
4 till 7 this afternoon here on GPB and online at gpbnews.org.
We're back on Political Rewind. Jim Galloway, Vice President Pence, is in town. Eric Erickson is staging his resurgence conference this weekend. And we mentioned this on our show earlier in the week, that it's ironic in a way, because back in 2015, before we had a Republican nominee, candidate Trump was disinvited from that gathering because Eric Erickson was so offended by comments he made about Megyn Kelly after that first Republican debate. Now they've kissed and made up. He's supporting Trump, and Pence is in town.
Pence was in town, and it was a red meat speech. Nothing terrifically new. He did toss Brian Kemp, who's in the audience, some support. Mm-hmm. On the Georgia's new anti-abortion heartbeat law, he portrayed 2020 as an existential contest.
Let's listen. Robert Jemison was over there for GPB News and captured some of the Mike Pence speech. Let's listen to what one of the things that Pence had to say, just like what Jim Galloway is talking about.
Frankly, we got a lot more work to do. Got a lot more work to do, and there are challenges that lie ahead. The fact is that all of this progress could be lost with one bad day in November in 2020. I mean, all you have to do is look at that debate that took place this last week. Y'all watch that debate? I mean, it was kind of hard to watch. I mean, those people were standing so far on the left, I thought that stage was going to flip over.
So, you know what I think was interesting about the vice president? Two things, Mike Thurman. We didn't talk about we played a bite that kind of goes along with the Republican talking point right now about the socialist Democrats. And we know that theme is going to be heard throughout the campaign. But there's another interesting thing I thought about. In a longer segment of the speech, Pence laid out what he says are the arguments for why Trump should be reelected. He said the economy is booming. The job rate is up. There's less unemployment. He specifically said that African-American employment is up. Such an interesting contrast to what President Trump does when he goes out on the stump and can't seem to focus on the issues that Republicans would like to say are the accomplishments of the administration. So address both of those, if you would.
Well, you just outlined the greatest challenge facing President Trump, which is, of course, President Trump. He does have some things that he could run on. The economy is strong, or has been. You know, unemployment is low, but that's not what he focuses on. He attacks women of color in Congress. He attacks a congressman from Baltimore. There's this ongoing, almost maniacal need to create divisiveness and racial insensitivity in our country. And I think it might be good for Democrats, but I think it's unfortunate, not just for Republicans, but it's unfortunate for our country that our president continues to double down on issues that create an environment where, rather than coming together as Americans to face the threat from Russia or North Korea, we continue to become immersed in this morass of I don't want to call it hate. Yeah, it's racial hatred. That's unfortunate.
I know Galloway wants to jump in. Let me ask you one follow-up, if I could, and then you, please, Jim. The racist tropes are one thing. This notion that Democrats are socialists is something else that I'd love to ask Jackie about in a couple minutes. Mm-hmm. But when Mike Pence talks about the Democratic candidates for president moving to the left, being liberal, doesn't call them socialist, but says how liberal they are, he has some factual information to back that up, doesn't he?
Well, there are candidates who are running for the Democratic nomination or who are liberal or even to the extreme left. But what you're beginning to see, if you look at who the front runner is, who is a very center left candidate, and if you look at where I think ultimately the most Democrats are, they are more moderate and centrist, and I think that is the path to victory.
Jim?
One of the people, someone else who was at this gathering that Pence was at, was U.S. Senator Tim Scott of South Carolina. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what he talked about, but his presence was kind of interesting because on Thursday, a Representative Will Hurd of Texas announced that he was not going to seek re-election. He was the only African-American Republican in the U.S. House. And with his departure, Tim Scott would become the only African-American Republican in Congress, which I think really underlines a serious problem for Republicans.
Yeah, and it also raises questions about what the heck is happening in Texas, where incumbent Republicans who don't want to run. Jackie, weigh in on all this. I mean, first of all, let me ask you. Democrats, we saw it in the debate the other night. We'll talk about that in a minute. Some real liberals on that stage.
But yes.
Socialists?
When we talk about giving away this and that free, everything's free, 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 at some point you have to wonder who's going to pay for all that. So, I mean, I do think, I mean, and clearly, I mean, the Democratic Socialists of America are in Atlanta this week. So I think you have to actually talk about it. And quite honestly, I know you mentioned this earlier before the show, part of the challenge I think we have is that people don't really understand what socialism is, what real socialism is. And so I do think we need to have an educational process in our country to talk about what is socialism, what is real socialism, and what is this kind of progressive, not, but what are we talking about? And I think when we aren't clear about what we talk about, we get confused as a country. But back to President Trump, I actually agree with you. The biggest problem Trump has is, one, if the economy falls, he's in big trouble. That's just a fact. If the economy's strong, I think Trump will win, regardless of the fact that he has to deal with Trump. Which is, I agree with you, that's his biggest, I think his biggest challenge if the economy continues to be strong. Yes. What he doesn't do, which is exactly what he should do, which you mentioned, is he should talk about what he has done, which is appoint African Americans to his cabinet. He should talk about the First Step Act. He should talk about forgiving the HBCUs of, I think, $200 or $300 million. It was $300 million in debt. That's what he should talk about, the things he's actually accomplished, the things he's doing. Instead, again, remember, he's the New York developer, reality TV show, president who, for some reason, can't control what he says or just tries one thing after another. So I think we have a bit of a challenge, but luckily for Trump, and then I'll wrap up, is if you look at the stage of the last two nights of the Democrat debates, it was a feeding frenzy. I mean, it was sad to watch, quite frankly. And I'm not a Democrat. I'm not going to vote for any of them. But to me, it was kind of sad to watch these Democrats just tear each other apart. It's going to be a nasty primary. Quite frankly, I would be surprised if a moderate does come out of it. I think you'll see a very liberal left candidate who, quite frankly, will not win.
Yeah, it reminded me so much of the Democrat, of the Republican primary. with the 20 Republicans up there. But it is what it is. It's politics. But I think, to your point, and we do agree, but what we, back to the Democratic candidates, I think it's good for the party to have the debate and the discussion. It really is. And it's no different in terms of progressives or even socialists. Think about Freedom Caucus members. You don't define an entire party by its various component parts. And what we are seeing is a tremendous amount of energy across the Democratic spectrum. And I believe that once a nominee is selected, he or she will have united support, not so much for the nominee, but in opposition to President Trump. The downside of what he's doing is he's generating a tremendous amount of energy to oppose him, whoever the nominee is. Most Democrats, including me, I will take any of them in November to try to create a different trajectory for our country.
But you're right. You know, I mean, this 2020 should be a replay of Ronald Reagan versus Walter Mondale.
Yes.
You know, it should. I mean, that's the dynamic that should be existing.
Explain
right
what
now.
You mean by that. Mike Thurman immediately agreed. But yes. What are we saying?
Okay,
when we
this was the race for Ronald Reagan's reelection. It was 84, and Jimmy Carter's vice presidential candidate, Walter Mondale, was the Democratic nominee. The economy was booming. Everything mm-hmm. was going right, and Ronald Reagan was likable.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right.
Yep.
And
right.
He won easily.
He won very easily. Well,
and he came out with, to your point, the Morning in America commercial, right? So, right. You know, you wake up in America
it was
and
it's morning in America.
It was, right. Morning in America. It's all good.
Commercial.
Right.
The
Reagan.
It was a Morning in America moment mm-hmm. Rather than America in carnage.
Right. Or well, the you know, nightmare that will not end, and it, you know, which is what mm-hmm. we're in right now. And it's unfortunate.
It is unfortunate. I'm going to tie back to your comment about the congressman who is retiring from Texas. And I've said this numerous times on your show, Bill, and I'm going to say it again. In the hopes that someone might hear me. But one of the things that the Republicans are horrible about is they're horrible about going out and recruiting candidates. They're horrible about talking about how they're horrible about asking people to run, including them, listening to them. That's why I wrote the book. There's lots of information. But we're really bad. We're like, let's just see who happens to pop up and want to run. And quite frankly, I think that's why you see less minorities and fewer women on the Republican side in candidates than you do on the Democratic side, because the Democrats are fantastic about recruiting candidates. Y'all do a great job up and down the place, yeah. And Republicans are just terrible. So maybe someone will listen and take note and actually begin to recruit people. But until you reach out and actually tell people, I want you in my party, even if you don't agree with me, at least say, no, I want you in my party, then they won't believe that you want them in the party. Yeah. And Republicans have to do that.
And what Jack is saying is so true. Look, let me come out of the political closet mm-hmm. today.
Okay.
Here we go. Live public TV. I have friends who are Republicans.
Oh, my gosh.
I'm coming out the closet. What can I say, right? They are concerned about the rhetoric. They are concerned about the divisiveness. They are concerned about what appears to be race baiting. That's not who and what and who we are as America. The whole question about the citizenship question, as I thought about it a little bit more, is really about doubling down on that narrative, the us versus the other. And it was just one more opportunity to reinforce that message, that you are not a part of us.
But you know what? But Jim Galloway and Jackie Cushman, you both referred to trying to understand what a definition of socialism is as Republicans try to brand Democrats that way. But I read so much every morning, I frankly don't remember which publication I read this in. But I read a quote from a Democratic official who was outraged by that because he said, and I'm quoting indirectly, of course, that's absurd. We don't want a government takeover of everything. We're not about controlling the means of production. And I thought, oh, my gosh, that is so missing the whole, you know, to take a classic definition of socialism and try to use it as an argument against the Republicans or your colleague. It doesn't make any sense. And the reason I bring that up, Mike, is I watch those debates and I don't see anyone in that stage those two nights who seem to have an answer to the vision that Democrats are looking for, that Democrats want to put in, that really deals with answering the whole question about socialism. Does that make sense, what I just asked?
It does, but there were moderate candidates, Bennett, who spoke, I thought, very eloquently on moderate issues around health care and other issues. But you have to just acknowledge that you now have a millennial generation of individuals who are Democrats, who we love, but they perceive the world in a very different way.
No, but I think if I can extend the Ronald Reagan metaphor, yeah. I mean, there's an opportunity here for Democrats for a Ronald Reagan-like figure,
exactly.
who can channel the optimism.
Yes.
And the moral rectitude in a positive way.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, go right ahead.
I would totally agree. But I think if they do that, they have to do it from the moderate standpoint, right? Yeah. The traditional Democratic moderate standpoint, not the. If you look at socialism, it is the control of means of production. I mean, if you know, pull up anyone, pull out your Webster dictionary and pull it up, right? And I think if you start talking about government control, most of the country is going to say, no, thank you. The government can't do anything right anyway.
That's my point.
Right. I think there is a part for that person, but they have to come from the moderate side of the Democratic Party.
You're right on that point. You can't go from eliminating all private insurance. I mean, come on. It's just not going to say. But let me say this to Jim Galloway's point. I did have a chance to sit and talk with Joe Biden for an hour when he visited here. And then I was with him at a small gathering. That is the person he's attempting to be. Mm-hmm. He's attempting to ride above the fray, to talk about restoring dignity and respect to the profession of politics. That is exactly the strategy he's trying to implement.
Now, have you endorsed him or do you support him?
No, not yet.
Okay. You know, I don't know if Robert Jemison is back from the Resurgence Conference. If you are, Robert, and listening in the control room, we should post David Brooks' column in the New York Times this morning. He wrote something very interesting that relates to the point you're all making about a Democratic message that is uplifting. He said, for all her wacky ideas, Marianne Williamson may have a better idea of how to run against Donald Trump than anybody else running in the party, because she talks about just that, lifting us up morally and ethically, renewing the spirit of America in a new way. And I thought that was really an interesting point she made, not that she has a chance to be the Democratic nominee.
No, but she had a couple good paragraphs in that debate.
Mm-hmm. She did. It was fascinating.
I'm going to throw a twist of this, and I'm going to go out on a limb, which many Republicans probably won't like.
You have Democratic friends, too?
Oh, of course I do. I do have Democratic friends. I thought you knew that, Jim. So I didn't know that was news. So I'll go on to the other news. But yes, I have Democratic friends. But actually, it's interesting you say that. 55% of Republicans and 65% of Democrats do not have friends in the opposite party. That's a statistical fact, and that's part of what I talk about in my book, and that's part of the problem we have as a country.
Repeat that percentage again.
65% of Democrats and 55% of Republicans do not have friends in the opposite party. So imagine if, I wasn't going to go on this tangent, but thank you, Jim. Imagine if you live in New York and you were raised in the Democratic Party and you have no Republican friends and you watch MSNBC. And then imagine if you were born in Alabama, have all Republican friends, watch Fox News. Can you imagine those people would automatically hate the other?
Yeah,
absolutely.
That's really interesting.
And 20 years ago, if you walked into a room and you found out about parties, only 20% would automatically hate without knowing them, right? Now it's 50%. So we really have created this incredibly polarized environment. But what it's going to say, which I think is still interesting, is...
But that's a thesis to a great book.
Thank you. I'm going to send you a copy.
I love it.
But, I mean, not only does the Democratic Party need someone, quite frankly, who is uplifting and talks about optimism and what we can do together, quite frankly, I would say the Republican Party needs the same.
Well, I mean, certainly the Republican Party... I mean, Republicans starting with the White House, you mentioned it, Mike, demonize the Democrats in extraordinary ways, and beyond that, demonize people of color, and you know, it. Where does it start? You know,
well, and what we true, but where can we end it?
That's right,
and that's what we really need to focus on now. And it didn't just start with Trump, by the way. Let's not put this on Trump. This is an evolution of some 30 or 40 years. Right.
I want to move on just for before we get to our final break and ask you a quick question, and then you get welcome to weigh in sort of briefly. What you saw on the stage Thursday night when Kamala Harris and Cory Booker and a few of the other more marginal candidates all went after Joe Biden because he was Barack Obama's vice president, attacking the Affordable Care Act, attacking the Obama policies on sending undocumented immigrants back to Mexico. Where, you know, forget about how breathtakingly strange that was to people who watch the debates and said, why are they attacking the most popular Democrat in the country? How is that going to play with African-American voters in states like South Carolina? And when the primary gets to Georgia, how is a Kamala Harris, how are they going to handle what they did to the Obama legacy on that stage?
Well, sitting here today, I can only speak for one African-American voter. I was disgusted by it. Mm-hmm. I did not like it. It was not only was it just bad politics. Even with Trump being Trump, very rarely is there a Republican who will criticize him, much less a nominee in the party.
It was breathtaking.
It was just, it made no sense whatsoever.
And I talked to Calvin Smyrie the next morning, the state representative out of Columbus. He was there, and he's a friend of Biden's, and he said basically what this was Joe Biden has connected himself so closely to Barack Obama that, and the people on that stage couldn't pry them apart. So in order to make that separation, you have to go after Obama.
But Jackie, when you come to a state with a large African-American Democratic population like South Carolina for their primary, you've accomplished two things if you're one of those critics. You have angered black voters who revere Barack Obama, and you've given Joe Biden the chance to put himself even to cement even more firmly his relationship with a popular president.
Oh, I totally agree. I think it was not very smart of them to do. It clearly was not kind of them to do. I don't know why they did it. I mean, the only thing I can think of is that, like, again, it was like a feeding frenzy.
Yeah.
And they couldn't help but attack and attack and attack. And it, quite frankly, I had to turn it off because it was quite frankly horrible to watch.
All right.
It's almost assured the fact that either Michelle and or President Obama will assert themselves in this race at the appropriate time.
We'll watch that. All right, we're going to come back to local politics in a couple of minutes, but first we're going to take this break. This is Political Rewind. Let's...
Downton Abbey is coming to a movie theater near you, and right now GPB has your opportunity to see the new feature film before anyone else. Join us on Sunday, September 15th in Atlanta for an advanced screening and VIP reception. Tickets are limited, so make sure we hear from you now. Go to gpb.org/Downton tickets to find out more and reserve your seat. That's gpb.org/Downton tickets. Don't miss out on this opportunity to support GPB and see Downton Abbey on the big screen. Downton Abbey is coming to a movie theater near you, and right now GPB has your opportunity to see the new feature film before anyone else. Join us on Sunday, September 15th in Atlanta for an advanced screening and VIP reception. Tickets are limited, so make sure we hear from you now. Go to gpb.org/Downton tickets to find out more and reserve your seat. That's gpb.org/Downton tickets. Don't miss out on this opportunity to support GPB and see Downton
Abbey. Welcome back
to
Political Rewind. If you've been listening to the show lately, you know that we're heading to Augusta pretty soon to do our show in front of a live audience at the Jesse Norman School of the Arts. Monday, August 12th, we'll do the show at 7 o'clock that night, and we would love to have you join us. I've said several times now, it's our first trip to Augusta, and so we want to meet as many of you as we can, give you a chance to weigh in on the issues that matter to you. Jim Galloway's coming out with me, which I'm very happy about. So just go to the Political Rewind page, politicalrewind.org, click on the link to register for your free tickets, and we'll see you in Augusta. It's going to be fun.
It'll be a blast.
Jim, this week, a angry crowd turned out for a community meeting in Cobb County. People who are worried their chances of getting cancer are dramatically higher because of a medical sterilization plant, Sterigenix, which is essentially at Sandy Springs, Atlanta border, right?
Well, it's in the Smyrna area,
right?
Down in South Cobb.
Right, Smyrna, that's right.
Yeah,
thank
right.
you. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
And the background on this is on July 19th, some friends of ours, you know, Andy Miller over at Georgia Health News, and partnered with someone from WebMD, and they published a report that said last year in 2018, the EPA noted that there were 3 census tract hotspots for cancer, and 2 of them were on the Cobb-Fulton border, and 1 was in Covington. And both were connected to the rise of ethylene oxide, which was a material used in 2 plants, one near Smyrna, 1 in Covington, that sterilized medical equipment through the use of that gas. And The EPA in 2016, I think, they upped it from a cancer-linked chemical to a cancer-causing chemical.
Andy and his partner on this story contrasted how government has not responded in our communities to Willowbrook, Illinois, where they had a plant, I think it was a Sterigenics mm-hmm. plant, where as soon as EPA found a potential link, a higher risk of cancers because of this chemical, they shut the plant down. Officials in the state got so angry, were so concerned about it, that the plant was shut down. One of the reasons for the anger meeting the other night is we've noticed that very little has been done here.
EPA did not put out any kind of public notice about this.
They knew about it.
They knew about it. The state Environmental Protection Division also knew about it. Also did not make any public notice. No one knew about this until mid-July.
So, Jackie, I want to turn to you on this because if the maps that I've seen are correct, it is conceivable that you happen to live in a neighborhood that could be affected by the emissions from this plant.
Yeah, you're right. I'm not far from that area at all. So, and I haven't looked at the map. I'll have to do that. But I want to, first of all, commend the AJC. I've done it a couple of times on this show that one of the things you're really good at is investigative reporting and turning things out and making sure they're public, along with this, along with the tax commissioner story this past week, which I appreciate since he collects our taxes. But I think it is really important. I think I'm really glad to see that the citizens are out. It's a bipartisan effort to make sure that the information is out, that the proper steps are taken. And to me, that's really where all the action should take place, is we need this community bipartisanship to work together to make sure our communities are as safe as they can be. So I'm looking forward to see what happens. But I appreciate your coverage and the AJC's coverage on this.
The governor took his time in speaking out about this, Jim.
Yeah. And this kind of goes to the Sunday column that I've got that's already posted. That really what you had this kind of bipartisan crisis management team form in Cobb at a very low level. I mean, there was County Commissioner Bob Ott, State Representative Eric Allen, and State Senator Jen Jordan all kind of overlapped and represented that same system, that same community, and they all got together and they started mapping things out, and they put on this Tuesday gathering over at Campbell Middle School. The fire marshal had to be called because there were too many people. They got turned away, and that's how that's when people really started paying attention. The governor on Thursday, about 2 weeks after this, the first report hit, made his first public acknowledgement of the situation.
But now we know that EPD, which is what our version, the state version, the Environmental Protection Division, has been mobilized to look into this, to see what they may or may not want to do.
Right. But the initiative has come at the local level.
Right.
Because at that Tuesday meeting, it was really kind of interesting to watch. You had the city of Smyrna volunteer to help fund an independent testing of the atmosphere, the local atmosphere. Then you had Lisa Cupid, the Democratic commissioner in Cobb County, who's going to run for chairman. She stepped up and said Cobb ought to do the same thing. Next day, Mike Boyce, the Republican incumbent, said, yeah, let's do it.
You know, Mike, what's interesting about this is Galloway's Sunday column talks about how interesting it is to have bipartisan cooperation on this. But, you know, we're living in times when it seems to me things have got, if they're not happening at the federal level because of paralysis or because of an administration that is increasingly passing executive or issuing executive orders that give a lot of freedom to businesses and the like, things have to happen at the local level these days.
Well, yes, two things. First, great reporting, Jim. I mean, it's been phenomenal. And you're absolutely right, Bill. I think Americans are just getting fed up with it. And we have to address the problems that we face. And oftentimes, these problems transcend race and geography and politics. What's unique about the situation here in Cobb is that typically these, and there's this whole school of thought around environmental racism that typically is a low-income community being impacted, that these plants either were built near or around low-income individuals. What's unique in Cobb is that some of the upper crust in Cobb and North Fulton are being potentially impacted. The outtake, though, is that this has the potential to create a new model as to how we address these issues wherever they might manifest themselves, whether it's in upper or lower income communities. It's a template that if and when it becomes successful, it can be transferred and migrated to other parts of our state and even our country. So the potential good will emanate far beyond the neighborhoods that might be affected.
By the way, Metro. Jackie, I'll give it to you, but Tom Faust wanted to let me know that the reporter from WebMD who worked with Andy Miller is named Brenda Goodman, so we give her a shout-out.
Oh, thank you.
Go ahead.
Thank you for that. No, I was going to say thank you. You basically are giving a commercial for my new book, because what I talk about, I can't tell you how much I appreciate that, Our Broken America. I know. I had no idea. Thank you. You're going to be my forward. That's it. But my whole point is, in this book, is that we really have to come together at local problems, and we have to solve things at local community level, and then actually I talk about making a blueprint so others can use it. So it's like you read the book.
Jim, the problem with that is that in this case, local officials got together to identify the problem, but they can't solve it without the intervention of higher officials in the state.
No, and Governor Kemp has now signaled that he's paying attention.
Right.
But what this group did was they helped and encouraged the movement, the organization of local citizens that created the momentum that could not be ignored.
Yeah, we should point out when Mike talks about the mix of lower and upper income households that might be affected by this, the reporting that I saw suggests that the governor's mansion could very well be within the zone of toxicity.
The Home Depot headquarters with 10,000 employees, possibly SunTrust Park.
And the other plant, not the same company, a different company that also does medical sterilization, is in Covington. Mm-hmm. And we're going to probably be looking to see in the weeks ahead, there'll be reporting on what they're doing out that way. And Covington is not far from your territory.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And these things, you know, the environment transcends and, you know, we all impacted by it. We have our own challenges in DeKalb County. Right now, we're faced with the contamination or at least reducing emissions or releasing toxic materials into the South River.
Yeah.
But the South River impacts Fulton, Clayton, DeKalb, Rockdale, all the way to Jackson. And one of the things we need to do is work across county lines to make sure that we have a safe and clean environment. Mm-hmm. And to your point, the environment, you know, and we always kind of defaulted to the environmentalists. But it's not just the environmental. It's not just the people on the left that can benefit by us being better stewards of our natural resources.
I totally agree. I've been involved for decades with Trust for Public Land, which has worked to save the Chattahoochee, the headwaters all the way down through Atlanta. Now, we're now working all the way down to Columbus and beyond. But it's really important. I mean, regardless of your political beliefs, I mean, we live on this earth. It's earth that I believe that God gave us, and we need to be good stewards of it. And that means making sure we take care of it.
Jim, we're not going to have a lot of time with this, but we might as well bring it up while we're talking about the environment. We are also dealing with a situation in which you suddenly have one of the most highly respected consultants, pollsters, focus group masters, Frank Luntz, who a number of years back told Republicans, don't pay any attention to global warming. It's not an issue. Climate change is not an issue for you. He's suddenly saying, Republicans, you better pay attention because it's real. That is a sea change.
Yeah.
And not to be a punning.
He appeared appeared at a special Senate Democratic hearing with two younger Republicans, because that's where the interest is coming from. It's from younger Republicans, not older Republicans. What's interesting, of course, is that Frank Luntz worked with this guy named Newt Gingrich.
Oh, that's right.
Contract with America.
Right. Oh my gosh, that's right. It was Luntz who came up with
part of Luntz's. Yeah.
He created the vocabulary that Newt Gingrich used, and now he's advising Senate Democrats on what kind of vocabulary they need to sell Republicans on climate change.
But Republicans are being told they better pay attention too.
Oh yes, yes.
I was at the news conference at the front lawn of the Capitol, Jackie Cushman, when your dad rolled out the contract with America, and it won them a full sweep of Congress, and your dad became Speaker.
I know. It's still amazing to me that he was able to do that and get all of those different people who were running for office to actually stand there with him and agree to do it and then transfer through and do it. But, I mean, Franklin says right. And, like, again, I'm a big... I'm a big environmentalist in terms of we need to be a good steward, and regardless of whether or not, I think his actual message is, regardless of whether or not it's actually happening, we need to be good stewards of our planet and take care of it.
All right. Thank you, Jackie Cushman. You get the last word in today's show. We're out of time. Jim Galloway, you'll be back with me at 2 o'clock on Monday, I hope.
Absolutely.
Maybe we'll talk more about this climate change stuff that Luntz was talking about. Jackie Cushman, one of the most... you're always smart. You're talking about your book. One of the most shameless performances you have ever
won. Thank you. Thank you.
We will talk about your book more when it's published on September 17th. You know, it's always a pleasure to have you, Mike Thurman, especially after your road crews finally got rid of the big plate in the middle of a road I travel on and repaved it. Thank you for that, Mr. Thurman. We're out of time. I'm Bill Nigut. We'll see you again Monday at 2 for another Political Rewind.